Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Thursday, April 27th. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Nikon Drawd Ben. The Blue Jays are rolling. We are nearing the end of April, and the Blue Jays are 16-9. They have a 640 win percentage. That is good for what? One, two, three, fourth. Fourth best win percentage across baseball, but the Blue Jays play in the American League East, so congratulations, you're in third place.
Yeah, it's pretty wild how competitive the division's been so far, but I think if you look at the Jays, you know, 4 weeks in at this point, this is pretty much how you would have drawn it up for them. Maybe there are details, of course, that would have gone differently, and you wouldn't have the Rays atop the division, but the Jays themselves are playing great, and they're mostly healthy pending the status of George Springer's hand after taking a pitch off of it in Wednesday's game. The rotation is doing really well, the back of the rotation in particular, and collectively they're just looking like a really good team. They look like a team that could earn a division title. I know the Rays are up there now, but this team could win the AL East. The Jays could earn a first round bye. Those still should be the goals for them. And the way they're playing, I think those are achievable goals.
Why are divisions, Ben?
I mean, it's funny. Why? Like, with the news of Oakland relocating, coming up in a few seasons to Vegas, I think that we could soon see a realignment with expansion in Major League Baseball. And I hope we do. I think that we would likely see eight divisions of four teams at that point, and the AL East would be done as we know it. But it's always been a tough division, right? Like, the last 30 years, this has been an incredibly difficult division.
But, like, why are we going to wait until 2027 to do that? Can't we just blow this up now? Why are there two leagues? What's the function? Like, what is the purpose of leagues and divisions right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a dated concept. Like, back in the day, they used to have their own umpires and their own, like, league presidents and stuff. Like, no, seriously, like, there used to be, I know you know this, but for anyone listening who doesn't, there used to be, like, National League umpires, and they would have, like, bigger strike zones. And, you know, it was a thing. You know, there was a job that was, like, to be the president of the American League, which obviously now they've amalgamated. It's just one organization. What purpose does it serve? I mean, I think that you want to separate your teams in some way so that they're moving towards something at the very end, obviously being the World Series. So I think having leagues makes sense. I guess you could go division free and just say it's the top six teams out of these 15 that make the playoffs. I kind of like divisions, but it certainly creates some inequity.
I got a league for you. It's called Major League Baseball, and there are 30 teams in it, and you should just line them up from the winningest to the losingest, and the top 12 or however many you want in your playoffs go to the playoffs. What do you want in the postseason? You want the best teams playing the best teams. You want the best talent, the teams that over 162 games have proven they are better than the others. So just line up the 30 teams. We've got a large enough sample, 162 games, to figure out which ones are better than the others. And let's carry on with it. There's no function. There's no purpose. Like, there's no logical reason to have divisions and leagues and to break things up this way. Right now, you got three of the top six teams in baseball by winning percentage are in the American League East. Only one of those teams is going to likely earn a bye. I mean, only one of those teams is going to win the division. The other two, if there are three playoff teams in this division, if there's four playoff teams in the division, the other three are going to be in a three-game wild card series. It's just completely unjust when you're likely to have, like, a Minnesota Twins in the AL Central or an Arizona Diamondbacks, and, you know, they're currently leading the West, and I doubt that's going to hold up. But, I mean, as it is right now, they're currently leading the NL West at 14-12. You're going to have another team that doesn't really deserve to be a division winner and to earn the reward that comes with that. Having that reward.
Watch out for the Pirates. They're leading the NL Central right now. I mean, I was looking at this the other day, actually, so I have the numbers handy, but you get occasionally a team that really is essentially a mediocre team that wins the division. The 05 Padres were 82-80, and they won the division. And the 06 Cardinals won, I want to say, 83 or 84 games, and they won the World Series. So, you know, you'll have those exceptional seasons where a team that doesn't deserve it makes it in. I think for the most part, the baseball playoffs demand so much of of teams and players that you're not going to make it through unless you're a really, really good team. Yeah, I do think that it's kind of an interesting question to say, like, what purpose do divisions serve? And like, it's a tough one to answer, which kind of does tell you something in itself. I think it gives you like a little bit of history. I think it gives you a little bit of rivalry and a little bit of a storyline throughout the season, as opposed to just this mass of teams that are competing against each other. But, you know, there's an argument against that too.
Yeah, no, if you're a child and you need a storyline, then it's there for you. And I'm going to leave it at that, because the Blue Jays are playing so well right now. They won 6 of the last 8, 15 of their last 21. And yes, we're going to like poke some holes in the Blue Jays in this podcast and we'll pick at some nits. But we really are nitpicking with the way this club's playing right now, because they're playing like the mid-90 win team that I think we both expected them to be this year. But I suppose we got to give some flowers to the rotation, because the last couple of podcasts we were kind of saying, oh geez, like there's some cause for concern with the way the Blue Jays starters have been performing to this point. Well, no longer. Over the last 8 games, Blue Jays starters have allowed 5 runs over 52 and a third innings, Ben. That is a 0.86 ERA, 48 strikeouts against 10 walks. This is a rotation that is absolutely rolling.
Yeah, they've been great. They've been driving the success of this team. It's not a total surprise, just given that all these guys individually have been very good at times in their careers. So they're not coming out of nowhere. At the same time, as you said, this has not been the case for the entire season. Certainly wasn't the case in 2022 for Berríos or for Yusei Kikuchi. So for the Jays right now, you've got to be really pleased with the way things are going. I think with Kikuchi in particular, he is just looking like a really important member of the staff. He's looking like someone who you really want taking the ball. You're happy when it's his turn to start. That's kind of shifted pretty quickly. He's got a 3 ERA. The Blue Jays have won every single game that he's pitched this year. He's only allowed more than one run one time in his 5 starts. Like, that's actually pretty remarkable, right? 5 starts, only once has he allowed more than one run. So this is exactly what you want. Of course, you wouldn't expect this to continue. You would expect some clunkers to come from Yusei Kikuchi as the Jays move forward here. But I think that if he can even be a 4 ERA pitcher the rest of the way, the Jays will be very happy with that.
So have you seen enough to have that kind of faith the rest of the way? Or do you still think that old habits could creep back in?
You know, there's always the possibility that some old habits could creep back in. I think with Kikuchi, going into the season, I would have pegged him for a league average ERA would be very good. I think that would have been a very, very good outcome. Right now, my expectations are higher. Having seen him pitch the last 5 starts, the way he's in the strike zone consistently, he's doing a lot of things really well. And so the changeup, the slider, obviously the fastball, these pitches are working for him. I think as we move ahead here, I would add to my expectations for Kikuchi. I would say that now I think he can be a slightly better than league average ERA starting pitcher, which is pretty valuable.
And he got him down and in. 92 mile an hour cutter there. This is a hard, hard pitch.
I'm not there yet. We'll see. Like, to me, he's being effectively wild lately, which is good. But I mean, how sustainable is that going to be for him? We'll see. To me, like the control and command has just been okay. I think he still gets away with a lot over the heart of the plate, and I still see him missing the zone by a great deal at times. So you're always going to be a little bit nervous when the control and command is kind of coming and going like that. And I think he's getting away with that, honestly, because he's sequencing a lot better. Like, I think, as you mentioned, there's just been a really nice balance to his stuff with that sort of formula of fastballs up into the arm side. I mean, sliders down, extension side, changeups down, arm side. I think that that's working well for him, and the way that he's mixing his pitches and kind of varying what he throws in different counts and what he starts hitters off with. I think that's allowing him to be somewhat unpredictable right now. I think that's making it hard to game plan against him. And I think that that means that even when hitters do get a mistake that he leaves in a bad part of the zone, the hitter's not necessarily anticipating it. So they haven't been able to get their barrel on it. So can he continue to sort of be effectively wild like this and unpredictable? We'll see. Or does the league sort of make an adjustment, or does he fall into some more predictable patterns? Like, I'm just never going to forget last May when it was like five or six starts and it was a 2.36 ERA and a FIP that was not much higher than that, like completely earned results when Yusei Kikuchi looked fixed, and then he was in the bullpen like a month later. So, you know, when I still see him sort of, and the other thing that sticks out to me is we're calling it a slider, but a lot of times what he's throwing is a cutter. Right. And in the past, I mean, we've seen that cutter not be super effective when it's in the low 90s and when he's leaving it in some poor parts of the zone, and he's having success with it right now. And maybe he's using it in better counts, or, you know, locating it more consistently. Maybe he's just getting away with it. I don't know. It's clearly a pitch he loves to throw. But, you know, I think the Blue Jays have tried to get him away from that pitch and more towards like a more sliderish upper 80s, more movement offering for a reason. So we'll kind of see how that plays out over time. But right now it's working. So, you know, who am I to say anything?
Yeah, and that's definitely working. I mean, we saw it against the Yankees. We saw it against the Rays. The White Sox, just a disaster right now. He was able to work effectively against them, which is no surprise. And sometimes you need a series like that where you're just facing a team that's clearly inferior. And I think we saw Jose Berríos benefit from that as well, where, you know, you're going up against a team that's not really clicking at all. But we saw Berríos execute effectively as well. And with some better pitch location, he seems to be avoiding the heart of the plate more. The numbers would back that up. The pitch charts would back that up, that he's not sitting on the heart of the plate. And so that's got to be cause for optimism. But at the same time, with Berríos, I tend to want to see this continue before I think that it's completely there. At the same time, the Jays have to be really encouraged with what they've seen from him in the last few starts.
Berríos' first inning against the White Sox, I would say, is the best inning I have seen him throw as a Toronto Blue Jay.
And he got him, 97 on the fastball. And what a way to get it started for Jose Berríos as he strikes out the side in the first.
His stuff in that inning, his conviction, his plan, I mean, everything was just incredible. And really, the entire start was really strong, and it's been his last three starts. But to me, like, just watching that inning really closely, and just the way that, I mean, his fastball, like, the not only the life that he had on it, but he threw his hardest fastball as a Blue Jay in that inning as well. So you're now mixing velo with like just a two-seamer that is like boring in, you know, on the hands of right-handed hitters in particular. And then just the slurve, which has been, I think, his best pitch all season, and which he is using really effectively down in the zone, which he is just throwing with so much more intent and so much more conviction. Like, he isn't just laying in slurves anymore. Like, he's really finishing them, you know, like he's really driving them and really snapping them off. And then he mixed in right on right changeups that he's started throwing a lot more now too, which is a pitch that, like, traditionally a lot of pitchers have not wanted to throw, because I think that the miss patterns with the right on right changeup can lead to a lot of damage. But Berríos is like finishing it and using it really effectively. And it's just like, it's when he's got his four seamer, his two seamer, his slurve and his changeup all working effectively, all kind of towards the edges, all tunneling off of one another and kind of creating those like cool X patterns that you'll sometimes see on Pitching Ninja and stuff like that. Yeah, this guy's got really good stuff, and this guy can be really, really effective. So as long as he continues pitching with the conviction that we've seen to this point, like, I actually have a lot of faith that he's going to be really good. I think he just can't get back into that mode where maybe, you know, there's a pitch or two that instead of really finishing and really driving and really throwing with conviction, he just sort of lays in and it ends up on a fat part of the plate and gets hammered.
And we saw last year, right, the problems that Berríos had were not necessarily to do with his stuff. He was throwing with his standard velocity at the time, 93, 94 miles an hour with the fastball. If you look at the pitch metrics, his slurve, his curve, I mean, that pitch was still moving. It's not like it totally lost its break, and yet it was an issue of location where he was leaving it too often over the heart of the plate. We saw the numbers, hitters destroyed his fastball in particular, but it really did connect to his pitch location. And so now, if some of that command is coming back, and demonstrably it is coming back, then that is a really good thing for the Jays. And of course, you know, this is always worth mentioning when it comes to Barrios, but it's not just for 2023. I mean, this is a guy who's under contract for a long time. And to have that stuff is step one. To have the command is step two. And then now to sustain it is going to be step three for him. And I'm intrigued to see if he can sustain this going forward.
Yeah, stuff's been really strong. With the top three in the rotation, Bassett, Manoa, and Gausman, in my opinion, moving 3-1. Is there anything that you want to touch on with them?
Well, with Manoa, you know, he was great in New York over the weekend against Gerrit Cole. Obviously, a very interesting matchup there. And Cole was great, too. Cole's probably the Cy Young favorite right now in the American League, the way he's pitching. Manoa, I think, took a step forward. Clearly, that was a big game for him. That was a big step for him to move forward. But looking at some of the numbers on Manoa, the break on his slider hasn't been there quite as much. And the location, I mean, he has not been able to locate his pitches to the edges of the plate as effectively as he did in 2021 and 2022. So again, these things can change. It's a month's worth of starts. It's not worth setting aside everything that we know about Alek Manoa. And I think if you ask people with the Blue Jays, there's a lot of optimism that he can get back to being that guy who was a Cy Young finalist. At the same time, by and large this year, he has struggled to have that same location, have that same pitch movement, especially on that slider. We talked last week about the changeup and how that pitch has not really been as effective so far this year. So he's got to find that location and he's got to continue to be in the zone, which we saw with the Yankees game. He was very much in the zone, attacking hitters. What he wants to be doing is you know, sustaining that and getting ahead, where he's ahead 0-1 in the count. All of a sudden, that sets everything up. So command, I think, is the big variable for Manoa.
The thing earlier in the season was he was just missing by too much. Like, I think the Alek Manoa with his pitch mix, like, he can miss by that kind of like ball width off the plate. That's fine. But when your pitches are almost in like that waist zone way out, you're just not going to get swings from big league hitters. I think that was his problem a lot earlier in the season. And then a lot earlier in the season, here we are on April 27th, but you know what I mean? And then against the Yankees, I just think that he was a lot more consistent with, even when he was missing, like not missing way off. You know, I thought his mechanics, whatever he worked on between outings, and I mean, Blue Jays will tell you it wasn't mechanical, but looks like it was mechanical. He clearly found a solution there. And we just kind of saw the Alek Manoa of old, where he was like, all right, everything's synced up, everything's working. Now I can go to work, like reading swings, understanding what the game plan is against me, thinking along with hitters, varying my pitch mix. His fastball had a ton of life against the Yankees. It was similar to like what Barrios was doing with that like boring sort of two seamer, just like in on right-handers. And honestly, the other thing we saw from Manoa was just like a bit of nastiness on the mound, honestly. And like, it started early in the game. I know you noticed this too. As Gerrit Cole is getting ready to start the game, Alek Manoa is still walking off from his warm-up, slowly, deliberately, not in a hurry to get back to the dugout at all. And the umpire has to like wave off Cole and say, hang on, we got to wait a second. I haven't asked if that was on purpose. I have a very strong suspicion that Alek Manoa knew exactly what he was doing in that moment, because I feel like we've seen him do that in the past as well, particularly at Yankee Stadium. So just kind of seeing like a little bit of that nastiness, a little bit of that edge right off the jump, and then carrying it through that outing, I think that was really encouraging as well.
You and I have definitely talked about that before. I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, where, you know, it's just this territorial aspect of it, where, you know, Gerrit Cole's about to start pitching, he's on the field, and it's vintage Alek Manoa. And you can understand why opponents don't like it. Like, I can very much understand that. And at the same time, it's part of the beauty of Alek Manoa and what he brings, right? It's part of the competitive edge. And I think that for the Jays, you're happy on days that he has that edge. You know, asking John Schneider about it, he's kind of like, you know, Alek probably regrets some of the things he said about Gerrit Cole. And then I talked to Alek Manoa about it. He's like, no, I don't regret anything. You know, it's like he gives the impression of being someone who really, really dislikes Gerrit Cole. I'll leave it there. It's certainly good entertainment. And look, it brought out the best in him. So, you know, he was certainly effective. And, you know, that's something that the Jays need from him.
Yeah, now he's just got to repeat it, and we'll see his next time out. A guy who is repeating is Chris Bassett, who over his last four outings, so you take away that season opener, that clunker against St. Louis, you look at his last four outings, it's a 2.19 ERA over 24 and two-thirds innings pitched. It's four consecutive quality starts. It's the Chris Bassett that we've seen for years through Oakland, through New York, and now with the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I mean, he's been great. I think that's exactly what the Jays were hoping for when they signed him. Some of those early season questions around pitch calm, velocity, they've been resolved. This is what they expected from Bassett.
The interesting thing that you saw with him in his most recent outing is he's actually moved on the mound. It's something that he started doing last year and just never really like got to a point where he wanted to use it in a game, and then like really hammered away at it over the offseason. And now he's basically like right over the middle of the rubber. And he feels like that just gives him more plate to work with. That allows him to sort of attack lanes more effectively. He thinks that's been really crucial for his slider. So when he's throwing his slider to righties, he's just starting at middle from where his body is on the middle of the mound. And he thinks that like that just lets its life play best through the zone. That helps keep it in the zone for a long time before it darts out, or he can even kind of land it for strikes at times too. He wants to start throwing his slider a lot to lefties as well, either kind of attacking the back foot or picking the outside corner. I think like a big frustration for Chris Bassett right now is that, because he's like the classic tinkerer, right? Like he's classic, always working on something. He hasn't had a lot of games where the score has been out of hand where you can try some different stuff. And so he doesn't want to try this like new slider he's thinking of using to lefties when he's got a 2-run lead or something. Because yeah, he might leave in a bad spot and it might leave the ballpark. But if Chris Bassett gets into a start where the Blue Jays offense like just ambushes somebody in the first second inning and he's got like a 7 or 8 run lead, like he's gonna start doing some funny stuff, like he's gonna start showing you some different wrinkles and some different things that he's kind of been cooking up in the lab. So I'm kind of hoping he gets that opportunity, because it would be kind of wicked to see him get that chance.
It reminds me of like the line with Jack Morris was always that he pitched to the score and that he could kind of like, you know, ease up a little bit if the Tigers or the Twins or Jays, whomever, had a big lead. And I mostly discard that as a myth for most pitchers, but I could actually see Bassett pitching to the score a tiny bit. And it would be fascinating to see like what exactly he uses in those situations. When, of course, if the Jays are up big, then that would be the time to do it and maybe mix in some of those different pitches.
And it's even like, it's so hard to follow along with him, because even the like whatever, if it's TrackMan or Hawkeye or whatever, like kind of provides the pitches to Savant or like that real time, like in-game pitch data, the classifications with Bassett are off so frequently. Like he's like, he was telling me like sometimes he'll throw a pitch, like he'll throw, I don't know, a two seamer or something, and he'll look up at the board behind him and he'll say he threw a changeup, and he'll be like, that's not a changeup. Like that's, you know, he said a lot of the time, like he'll look up at the board and be like, that's not what I threw. I didn't throw that at all. So it's even trying to follow along with him from a distance can be difficult. Like that's kind of the level of guile that this guy is bringing to the mound right now. But you know, the other thing with him is just that the stuff is, as you mentioned, with not only the velo, but I think the movement and the break as well has really improved over his last few outings. I think his sinker has been a lot better than it was maybe towards the end of spring training or in his first outing in St. Louis. And that's why he's seen it be as effective as it's been lately. That's always been a super, super effective pitch for him. And I think he's gotten back to that. And you know, I think it probably helps that he's sort of gained a couple inches of horizontal break on that pitch since the start of the season.
Yeah, it certainly worked out. As for Kevin Gausman, it's interesting just to see how he continues to tinker in his own ways at times and search for it. I mean, in his most recent start against the Yankees, he describes it afterwards as a grind. And I'm sitting there looking at my scorecard. I'm like, you just struck out 11 hitters. You know, you didn't walk anyone. You're going up against the New York Yankees. Aaron Judge had nothing against you. And you're like, yeah, that was a grind. Like it's kind of indicative of how good Kevin Gausman can be when he's on or even when he's not on. Even in that game too, like Anthony Volpe, great player, facing him for the first time, strikeout, strikeout, strikeout. Like it was like JV facing varsity. It was like totally unfair. And that's the kind of ability that Gausman has. And it's not a surprise, but it's pretty significant for the Jays as they move ahead that he continues pitching like an ace.
he made such a great adjustment in that outing, using his fastball more down in the zone. Like you saw Houston really ambush those heaters up and sit off the splitters down in an outing prior. And like, this is something we've seen from Gausman throughout his time that with the Blue Jays. He can get a bit predictable at times. And that's because he's been so successful with the fastball up and the splitter down. And he's like just carving up lineups. So why change anything when it's working that well? But every once in a while, you're going to run into a lineup that's going to execute a really good approach against you. And you got to make a little adjustment. So Gausman comes out and you could see it from early on in the Bronx, like firing fastballs down in the zone, you know, like not only throwing fastballs up. And like when he just does that, It makes his splitter so much more effective because hitters can't just sort of eliminate anything down. And I think it helps him get a lot more whiffs with his splitter, which is a pitch that already gets a ton of whiffs. And Kevin Gausman really just has, like, we probably don't talk enough about what strong control and command that he has. He walks so few hitters, so he can do that with his fastball. Like, he can put it down in the zone, maybe not at like 97. Like, I think when he's reaching up for like extra velo, it's probably going to be up in the zone, but like his fastball at 92 to 94 down in the zone can be totally effective when sort of tunneled well off of his splitter, which starts beneath that, or maybe sometimes even lands in the zone. And then, by the way, let me just mix in the occasional slider to remind you that I have it and steal a strike first pitch. It's a pretty good formula to strike out 11 over 7.
Yeah, it's a great adjustment and not easy to do. Like you said, I mean, a lot of pitchers, that might take them a month. You know, it's something that Kevin Gausman can do pretty quickly because he is at a point now where his command is just that much better. So it adds up to some really good results for him and for the Jays.
Are there any concerns, any pressing questions that you have with this team right now?
If we're going to nitpick, I would say, well, basically, the short answer is no. The short answer is no. They're a good team. They're playing well. They're mostly healthy. So no. But I think there are always ways to nitpick, and you can bet that the front office is doing that. They should be doing that. They shouldn't be sitting on their laurels. They're third place team right now.
Third place team. In the AL East, man.
Third place team.
Yeah.
Third they got place some team. Work to do. So, you know, I think, ideal world, you've got someone at AAA who's pushing. You know, ideal world, Addison Barger would be hitting or Otto Lopez would be hitting, and those guys are not. Ideal world, Adam Simber's healthy and Anthony Bass is pitching better and Zach Thompson looks a little better than he has. Casey Lawrence has actually been pretty good at AAA, but, you know, I think scouting report wise, you're probably looking at a five and dive at best with Casey Lawrence. So, yeah, there are little places that you can nitpick. Do you see anything big? I definitely don't see anything big.
Yeah, I would say with the starting rotation pitching as well as it is, that is very good for the Blue Jays because there is not a lot of depth there on the starting side. As you mentioned, Zach Thompson, who, you know, started the season as the number six, not off to the greatest start. Bowden Francis is hurt. And I think with Casey Lawrence and Drew Hutchison, like, you know what you're going to get. As you said, like, you know, the Blue Jays would not be counting on them to haul innings for a long time, you know, if one of their current starters went down. So, yeah, like, it is good that the Blue Jays rotation is as effective as it is and also as healthy as it is. And we mentioned this last time, Blue Jays have had tremendous injury luck this year, not only with like avoiding any major, you know, injuries to their starting staff, but like they keep having hitters getting plunked in the hands and coming away from it scot-free. It happened to Santiago Espinal, happened to George Springer, both of them hit on the hand, removed from a game, x-rays came back negative. And we'll see what's, you know, how much time Springer needs to get back to himself. But Santiago Espinal like wears a Gerrit Cole 97 mile per hour heater on Saturday and then is back in the lineup on Wednesday with three hits. Yeah. I mean, you can't make this. That's incredibly good fortune. Dude, Santiago Espinal thought his hand was broken. Chai and I talked to him after the game the other day. I mean, he was telling us, like, I thought my hand was broken. I couldn't move it. I go into the x-ray room and they're trying to get me to put my hand into positions on the x-ray table and I can't because I can't move it. That's how bad it was. And then it's like 2 days later, he's taking ground balls. And 3 days later, he's hitting off highlight velo pitching machines. And then 4 days later, he's in a game getting three knocks, which is like as many as he had in the season going into that point. Kind of other interesting thing to hear from Santiago Espinal, just something that you hear from a lot of hitters, is he started the year trying to be that, yeah, I'm going to go the opposite way. I'm going to take pitches. I'm going to be this patient guy. It really didn't work out for him at all. And then he came into that game on Wednesday. He was like, you know, I'm just going to do what's always kind of worked for me and pull the ball. And you know, just if that's the contact I get, that's the contact I get. Three hits. Sounds kind of similar to what Danny Jansen went through when he was trying to be this all fields guy and, you know, trying to be like Mr. Work and Approach guy. And then it was like, you know what? I'm just going to kind of look for something in her half and try to yank it. And all of a sudden, Danny Jansen, you know, had like 15 homers last year and came out of a funk in a really big way recently this week. Too. We've heard similar things from Bo Bichette last year. He was like, yeah, when I was struggling, like I was just trying to be someone I'm not. And then when I bought back into the aggressive approach and what I do best, all of a sudden results came. So interesting to hear Santiago Espinal mentioning something along the same lines.
Yeah, that's big for the Jays to have him back. And we'll get to Whit Merrifield in the second half. But that combination gives the Jays a couple pretty good options at second base right now.
Does the second base rotation kind of stick out to you, sort of the depth on the position player side, like as something that the Blue Jays need to still get some answers and settle going forward?
Honestly, I feel like they have their answer. To me, it's just play Whit Merrifield. And, you know, Espinal has been great. You want to see that. That's a great story. He'll be in there on days that Merrifield's playing left field, and you've got Varsho or Kiermaier on the bench, particularly against a lefty. So it's not that Espinal won't play. He'll also, you know, play on days that Chapman DHs, for example. Yeah, to me, the way Whit Merrifield's playing, you just roll with him right now. I think it's, I would keep it that simple if it was my call.
Simple enough. Let's step away, but when we come back, talk a little bit more about Whit. We got to talk about Nate Pearson, got to talk about defense, all that, and so much more when we continue on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producers are Nick Andrade and Christian Ryan. And Ben, I just wanted to kind of pick up the pin on Whit Merrifield from before the break when I realized, like, oh, we need to take a break just as we start talking about Whit. It sounds like you are thinking, as long as Whit Merrifield is hot, you got to just ride this thing while it's rolling.
You know, to me, you look at the numbers, and it's obviously been a short period of time that he's been in Toronto, but he's actually been quite good here. I have them in front of me with the Blue Jays, 63 games, 293 hitter, 343 on base percentage, 431 slug. That's good for a 774 OPS. And those numbers, to me, are better than what I would have guessed. They are better than the numbers that he had in Kansas City with the Royals when he was like one of their all-star core players. He's 34 years old. How long this lasts is an open question. We'll see. But at this point, he's producing. And for a team that went into the season with their options pretty open at second base, I think you should ride the hot hand. I think that is right now with Merrifield. I'd be starting him 5 days a week if I was the Jays.
Yeah, he is, to your point, performing better right now than even when he was in the prime of his career. So that probably tells you that, yeah, it's probably not going to be like this all the time, but you certainly take it while you can get it. The thing that Whit Merrifield is doing that like is really impressing me is he's giving you a great plate appearance. Like he's taking his walks when they're there. He's working some really good approaches against like some really tough relievers, and when he's not walking, like he's doing what he does with his, you know, pretty proven contact ability to this point in his career. He's got such a flat bat path, and he believes like that allows him to, even when he's not feeling his best at the swing or not driving pitches, that allows him to still get results and still get on base and, like, you know, still find hits here and there just because of how long his bat stays in the zone and how flat his path is. And then I went and looked it up the other day, and it was like, oh, Whit Merrifield is like top 10 in MLB this year when hitting, like when he's behind in the count. And I was like, oh, well, maybe there is something to that. That's kind of interesting how that lines up. And the other thing about Witt, like just from talking to him, like he doesn't even feel like he's in a good place at the plate right now. And you listed off the numbers and like the success that he's had, but like he'll tell you that like he thinks he's missing pitches that he should be doing damage on. Like he thinks he should have a bunch of homers at this point. He can tell you about some hung breaking balls he's just been a tick off against. You look at the damage for Whit Merrifield in recent seasons in particular, and it's really been like, it's been anything on the inner half, but it's been especially fastballs kind of elevated on the inner half. And he's had some pitches, some heaters in that spot that he has just not done the damage on that he thinks that he should. Look up the two that Gerrit Cole threw to him, two fastballs up and in. And like Gerrit Cole is like never pitched Whit Merrifield in because of the book on him, like as a righty, is do not pitch Whit Merrifield in. And Cole came into him, and the first time Whit was kind of caught off guard by it, didn't love his swing on it, went up the second time looking for a pitch in that spot, and then like just missed it. And you can see even in his reaction after those plate appearances, like just kind of like grabbing the barrel of the bat and just kind of upset with how things went. So it's kind of interesting to hear him talk about that, you know, even for as hot as he's been, as successful as he's been, like he thinks that he's, you know, he believes he's going to be better than this going forward.
Yeah, that'd be great for the Jays if that happens. If it ends up being that he sustains this or even falls off a bit, they're probably good with that. But, you know, you also look at what he's been able to do just as far as controlling the strike zone. He's not striking out a whole lot, only 16% strikeout rate, which is in line with what you'd see from him in the course of his career. So again, it's not as though he's striking out 30% of the time and getting all kinds of luck. He is putting the bat on the ball pretty consistently. He's got a handful of stolen bases. We saw one in the double steal on Wednesday. So he's a guy who, you know, at this point, trending toward a kind of solid offensive season with maybe 20 steals. Like, you're thrilled with that if you're the Jays.
And this is my moment, Ben. This is my moment to do. I've had this like stray Whit Merrifield stat all year that I love. And I've been like fighting to get it on the broadcast for the longest time. And we actually ended up doing it on Tuesday, but like we did it like really quick. And then a bunch of things happened in the game and it kind of got lost in the shuffle. I just love this stat. So then this is just kind of completely out of left field, but I'm going to do it here because I just need an outlet for this. Whit Merrifield, he stole third on Tuesday. It was part of a double steal with Espinal, I believe. That was Whit Merrifield's 57th steal of third base since he entered the league. And that is the most steals of third base of anyone since 2016 when Whit Merrifield entered the league. Whit Merrifield loves to steal third base. He is 57 for 62. Since 2016, since he entered the league, that is a 92% success rate. It goes, wow. Whit Merrifield in steals at third base. Whit Merrifield has 57. This is since 2016. Merrifield 57, Billy Hamilton 54, Jonathan VR 41. Like, that's the drop off. Whit Merrifield steals third base all the time. He has a 92% success rate doing it. He has attempted 62 steals of third since 2016. Only 8 players have even attempted 30 steals of third since 2016. This is something that like Whit Merrifield tries more than anyone and is successful at more than anyone. Only 8 players have even attempted 30 in that span. Whit's attempted 62. And the thing about MLB's new rules is it is only making it easier for Whit Merrifield, who already loves stealing third base, is already madly successful at it. It's only making it easier for him to be successful because MLB base stealers this year trying to steal third base are 80 of 87. That is a 92% success rate, right in line with Whit Merrifield's 92% success rate for his career at stealing third base. Last year, 2022, stealing third base, MLB base stealers were 78%. This year, it's 92 with the disengagement limits, with the pitch timer, with the bigger bases, with everything that's going on. So it's never been easier to steal third base. And Whit Merrifield steals third base more than anyone. You know, look for him to continue doing this anytime he reaches second.
Yeah, that's a cool stat. That's a really cool stat. Shout out also to Blue Jays legend Jonathan VR. Haven't heard his name in a while. yeah, I think that when it comes to stealing third, you look at that success rate, he should do it more. You know, he should do it as often as he possibly can. And it sounds like he is. I mean, with the attempts, it's not like there's a lack of trying there. You know, obviously there are situations you don't want to make the first out at third. You probably don't want to make the third out at third. So, you know, basically you're limiting yourself to, you got one out, you're on second base, go. And I expect that he's going in all those situations. So that's really cool. I mean, it's a great way to advance things. Also, if that's happening, it's a sign that things are going well because it means he's gotten to second base. So, you know, that's a good situation for the Jays to be in. Obviously, hitting toward the bottom of the order, that's what you like to see from guys like a Kiermaier, Whit Merrifield, and Espinal, who we talked about, Danny Jansen, who's starting to get going. When you have those guys contributing from the bottom of the order, and you've got your Vlads, your Bos, obviously doing things at the top, Matt Chapman, then you have the makings of a lineup that's just really tough on any given inning to work through.
Yeah, the steal of third, I think, is just a really underutilized high percentage play, particularly this year. And I think there's a lot of like old school baseball orthodoxy that the juice isn't worth the squeeze. Like the trade-off of getting thrown out at third like isn't worth it. You can probably score from second, but I mean, get to third and now all of a sudden a wild pitch gets you home, right? Or a passed ball. Like now all of a sudden the pitcher has to worry about you and maybe isn't going to be quite as convicted in throwing that breaking pitch in the dirt or isn't going to like really let loose with like as nasty as stuff in case he yanks one. And now you're scoring from third. Now you can score on a sac fly. I mean, yeah, you talk about productive outs, like you get to second base with none out and it's the job of the guy behind you to then hit a ball to the right side to get you to third. You trade an out for getting the guy to third. Well, why don't you just get the guy to third by stealing the base if you're capable and if the math works out? And base stealers will tell you it's all math, right? Like it's pitch time versus plus pop time versus your time from bag to bag, right? Like, and if the math's in your favor, you get a good jump, you can go. Base runners are getting better jumps this year than they have been in the past. Some of these leads are monstrous, and you've seen some of those like kind of hopping leads as well that a lot of guys are starting to utilize, which is really cool. I just think that there's, you know, if at 92% league wide stealing third base, go to third even with zero out, go to third with two out, like just go take that base, put yourself in position, and now you don't have to trade the out to get the guy to third, and now the guy at the plate can actually like just kind of swing away and get you home even with a sac fly to center.
So with nobody out, Whit Merrifield on second base, green light for me, let him go. I think that's a situation where I would challenge the baseball orthodoxy. If you got two out, I don't think I'm doing it. I gotta be honest. I think with two out, I think I'm just saying, you know, stay put unless you're getting a great jump off the guy, because I don't want to run into the final out of the inning and take a guy out of scoring position.
The other sort of stray thought that I just want to get in here and that I have no other place for is like we're starting to take the Blue Jays defense for granted. And there are a lot of like little defensive things that are happening right now that are being overlooked. I think back to the series in New York that you were at, and during the Gausman start, I think it was LeMahieu who like lined one to center, and it was incredible that Kevin Kiermaier even got close to it. Like it was the sort of ball that I think with the vast majority of center fielders just drops in, and Kevin Kiermaier like goes so hard for it, comes like razor thin close to make the catch, laid out for it, whiffed on it, it happens. It was like a 50-50 proposition. But who's right behind him backing up the play is Dalton Varsho, who is like sprinted over from left field and cuts that ball off before he gets to the wall, gets it in quickly. It doesn't become like a DJ LeMahieu triple. I think to the Berríos outing on whatever day that was, and Andrew Vaughn's at the plate, and Berríos is deep into his outing, and Vaughn like laces one to right field, and it is a ball that I do not think is caught last year or the year prior, but because George Springer's in right field, he makes it look routine. Like he just runs down this, and it was like well struck, man. It would have been like a triple digit exit velo. It was on a line. I do not think it was a super high catch probability, and Springer just runs it down and makes it look easy and like sort of like an over the shoulder catch and just eliminates a base hit. Little things like that are going overlooked, but those are like big steps forward for the Blue Jays in terms of outfield defense. And I think it's important to sort of point them out because these are sort of the little things, the little dividends that are going to compound and really pay off with wins over time.
Reaches for it, hits it to right field. Springer still going back, and he's got it. Boy, he just kept going and going and finally caught up to it.
I think, too, as long as we're talking defense, like, this is probably a good time to give Bobichat a little bit of credit for just making plays at shortstop, including a couple pretty good ones in the series finale against the White Sox on Wednesday with Kikuchi on the mound. I just think Bobichat gets a lot of flack for not being Ozzie Smith out there. And, I mean, he's not the best defensive shortstop in the league. I think that's fair to say. But at the same time, he's playing pretty well out there. And I think it's, you know, people are pretty quick to pile on him when it doesn't go well. But I don't know, a month in, like, it's not a problem. He's handling the one of the toughest defensive positions in the diamond, and he's doing the job. So I think that's worth noting as well.
I'll even go a step further, and you're totally right about Bichette, by the way. Like, his clock has looked a lot better at short recently. Like, his throat. Yeah, his time, right? That's honestly, I think, what it is for him. Like, I just think it's the clock and getting sped up. So his timing has looked a lot better. I'll extend it to Danny Jansen behind the plate, who called a really, really strong game for Jose Berríos against the White Sox. Like, Berríos had such a nice mix in that game, like, super even with his four pitches. I don't think White Sox hitters ever really felt comfortable with what they were going to get. Jansen also blocked a couple of, like, really tough balls in the dirt, like, showed some really good athleticism behind the plate to keep a couple of those sort of bounced slurves in front of him. And then, oh, by the way, hit like two homers in the game and had three hits.
Jansen with a fly ball that's well hit to left, and it's gone. Second of the season for Danny Jansen. It's a three-run shot and a 3-0 lead for the Blue Jays.
And then came back, and day game after night game the next day, caught Yusei Kikuchi, who is not an easy assignment. So I'll even say, like, just defensively behind the plate, Danny Jansen, even while he was slumping earlier this year and not contributing as much as he would have liked to offensively, is really making some contributions that I think are helping the Blue Jays win ball games.
Yeah, you need all those aspects of the team to be working. And defensively, we talk so much about the outfield. That is the biggest change that we've seen this year. But certainly the contributions of the shortstop, the catcher, those are big as well.
Somehow we've gone this far and haven't mentioned the name Nate Pearson. And Nate Pearson is a Toronto Blue Jay right now. He's back in the big leagues for the first time since October 2021. Your early impressions of Nate Pearson out of the Blue Jays bullpen, Ben?
Well, he was so close to making the Jays out of spring training. And they went with Zach Pop, and that decision has paid off at times as well, with Zach Pop looking really good for appearances this season. But at that point, the Jays told Nate Pearson, look, we want you to go down there and build on this momentum, because he had a really good spring. And they didn't want him to lose any of that edge, any of that momentum. And he didn't. He went down to AAA. He was getting good results. The velocity was there. You talked about the conviction that you've seen from guys like Yusei Kikuchi, for example, or Jose Berríos, for example. And the Blue Jays saw that from Nate Pearson in the minor leagues as well. And then in his one appearance in the big league so far, we've seen some of that conviction as well. We've certainly seen the velocity, a strikeout in his season debut as well. So it's early, but this is what you want to see from Nate Pearson. You want to see him in the strike zone, attacking hitters, big velocity, and, you know, doing that every few days, every couple of days from here to the end of the season. That's his role, in my opinion. I think that we're going to see, or we should see, a lot of Nate Pearson, and he's got a chance to really earn more reps and earn higher leverage as things progress from here.
Let me ask you this. Who right now has the best stuff in the Blue Jays bullpen?
Well, I mean, Trevor Richards has the best changeup, and that's really working. Nate Pearson has the best fastball. Zach Pop has the best sinker. Anthony Bass probably should have the best slider, but I'm not sure that it's really been there for him this year. Jimmy Garcia's got a nice mix. Tim Mays has got a nice two-seamer. I don't know. Like, I don't think there's a singular, or obviously Romano's, I'll say Jordan Romano has the, to answer your question, I will say Jordan Romano has the best stuff in the bullpen.
I will say Nate Pearson has the best stuff in the Blue Jays bullpen because he throws a harder fastball and a livelier one and a more consistently at this point located one than Jordan Romano. And he throws a slider that breaks more horizontally than anyone in the Blue Jays bullpen, save for Adam Simber. And it's the spinniest slider in the Blue Jays bullpen as well. And it's not really fair because like no one else in the Jays bullpen really like throws a curveball. Like Jimmy Garcia throws one every now and then, but Nate Pearson has the best curveball in the Blue Jays bullpen as well. So the guy who like entered to protect a 7-run lead the other day, to me, that's the guy with the best stuff right now in the Blue Jays bullpen.
And he's using it better than he has before, which is the big thing, because the stuff there, you know, on metrics, right? If you're looking at velocity, you're looking at spin rate, you're looking at how much horizontal or vertical break, you try to crunch the numbers. This isn't new for Nate Pearson. He's always had good stuff. That's why he was a high draft pick. That's why he's a top prospect. With the difference that we're seeing this year, small samples, obviously, very, very tiny sample in the major leagues, but the difference is he's using that stuff within the strike zone more consistently. And that's all they need from him. There's no illusions anymore. He's not going to be a starter. There's some talk about, hey, he can be a multi-inning guy. All right, like maybe. More likely, he's a one-inning pitcher in the mold of 90% of relievers in the major leagues right now. He might do some up-downs, but end of the season, if he has 50 appearances and 55 innings, that's totally fine. But he might have 70 strikeouts, you know, and if he keeps the walks under control, you're looking at a guy who can pitch and leverage and who can be a big part of what the Jays are trying to achieve.
I think you're looking at a guy who's going to be pitching in high leverage very, very soon. I think Nate Pearson is going to be moved to leverage very quickly. Like, look, the Blue Jays, they did the whole thing at the start of the year, go down to AAA, earn it. You know, they did that whole thing. He did. He's up here now. We can stop with the charade. The guy is absolutely dominant. Absolutely nasty. When he's controlling and commanding like he is right now, it's just elite stuff.
So how many appearances do you need to see before you put him into high leverage? Like before, let's say 4-2 game, seventh inning, you know, how many more appearances do you need to see before he's in that spot?
I think so. He's seen super low leverage. Next time you bring him in, maybe it's like a 4-run lead and test him with that. And then if he looks the way that he did against the White Sox, then no hesitation putting him in to protect a 1 or 2 run lead in the seventh inning.
You'd move that quick. I would be slower.
He's that good.
I would want to see 3 more appearances before I put him in high leverage.
I'm just done with it, man. I'm done with the charade. I'm done with slow play. And look at the strikeout of Andrew Benintendi against the White Sox and what Nate Pearson did there. First pitch, 99 at the knees, outside black for a called strike. Second pitch, strike to ball, curveball beneath the zone, gets like an absolutely disgusting, awkward swing from Andrew Benintendi. Third pitch, right back with 100, Ben, challenge fastball on the plate. 0-2. He's not like, oh, I'm going to waste one. Oh, I'm going to try to go above the zone. I'm going to try to get him explained. He was like, nah, man, I trust my fastball is that good and I can throw it on the plate right now. Boom. 100 on the plate. Benintendi can only foul it off. Fourth pitch. Pearson comes back with the curveball. Doesn't go strike to ball with it. Lands it outside, down and away. Called third strike to a lefty.
And that is strike 3 called. Finished down with a curveball as Pearson bounces back and puts up a good inning.
Are you kidding me? Like that strikeout, like I saw everything I needed to see, the command, the control, the curveball that Pearson's featuring right now, which is like a different curveball than the last time we saw him. Last time we saw him, it was like that rainbow mid-70s sort of, no, I don't want to compare it to Bassett, but like, you know what I mean? Like Stripling-esque almost curveball. Now it's this low 80s spike curve that he's sacrificed a bit of movement on, I guess, a little bit of action on, but like has made it a much more overpowering pitch. It still has like 18 miles per hour of discrepancy from his fastball, but it's just so effective when he is locating it both on the plate, in the zone for strikes, and also using it to get hitters to expand. I asked Nate Pearson the other day, I was like, are you going to throw more curveballs or sliders this year? And he was like, the way like I'm feeling with my curveball right now, it's probably going to be my curveball. And the league doesn't even really know that he has it yet and hasn't seen a lot of video on it yet. Like, I just think that Nate Pearson, if he continues to demonstrate the control and command we've seen to this point, is just going to be incredibly effective, incredibly nasty, and pitching leverage for the Blue Jays.
And there's no doubt that at-bat, great execution by Pearson. I just think it's one appearance. There's never been a question of his upside. I think you want to see just a little bit more. I would want to see three more of these, and then boom, you can pitch in the seventh inning ahead of an Eric Swanson. You know, like, that's, I would go there at that point, but not yet. For now, it would still be an Eric Swanson ahead of Nate Pearson.
I agree with you. It's still Swanson ahead of Pearson. And I'm obviously doing like a Julian Merriweather in New York thing, right? Like, you got to see it a bit more. Let me put it this way. If Nate Pearson performs, if he continues to look the way he has, like, he's not going anywhere when the Blue Jays, like, when Adam Simber's healthy. Like, if the Blue Jays get to a point where it's Mitch White's finishing his rehab assignment and Adam Simber's healthy, I don't think at that point you're optioning Nate Pearson. Like, I think at that point he'd be here to stay.
He's a big league pitcher. Yeah.
If Nate Pearson's on the Oakland Athletics, he's their closer.
Yeah, absolutely. The Blue Jays have a good bullpen. So that's part of the reason that he was optioned to begin with to start the season. We mentioned Richards before, but just, you know, he's striking out two batters per inning, almost 15 batters per nine. Like, this is a good bullpen. You've got some really good options here.
It's win time. It's time to finish messing around with things. Take your pick, man. There are a few other like kind of stray thoughts and odds and ends from the last week. So do you like Vlad Jr.? Do you like Charlie Montoyo, Teoscar? Where do you want to go?
Let's start with Vlad Jr. Then let's touch on Montoyo. As for Teoscar, it'll be interesting to see him back in Toronto. You know, nice for the fans, nice for Teoscar.
Sounds good.
Okay, so Vlad Jr., I just find it so interesting that he hates the Yankees. Maybe hate is, I don't know if that's the right word, but he seriously dislikes the New York Yankees. And now the fans are aware of this. They are showering him with booze every time he steps up. It's really interesting. And it's like, he's not saying this as like, because at first I think I misinterpreted it, you know, because he said this in a few settings. He said this to like a school visit. And I kind of thought he was saying it as like, you know, riling up the kids, like, you know, this is kind of fun and it's great entertainment. And I was like, this is fun. Like, baseball should be like this. And then the more he's been asked about it and the more he's reiterated his stance, which is that he would never sign with the Yankees. That's a quote, never, not even dead. That's another quote. He doesn't really want to talk about it. He doesn't really want to go into detail as to why. He cites personal and family reasons, but he seems to me to be pretty serious about this. Like, he really does not like the Yankees. He does not want to sign with the New York Yankees and he won't play for the Yankees. And I just find this so interesting, you know, because from a leverage standpoint, he's 3 years away from free agency. You might think that the team that historically has spent the most on free agents would be a team that you might want to keep in your back pocket as you contemplate extensions with the Blue Jays, as you position yourself in the market more broadly. And Vlad Jr. is saying, no, I don't care. I don't need that leverage. I don't want it. I don't want anything to do with this franchise. I just find it really interesting that he is so open about despising the New York Yankees. And it's like, it's very interesting to me. It's unusual. And I think he's pretty serious about it. Like, and in trying to be respectful to him about it, like, you know, he doesn't want to talk more about it. I'm not going to pry on a topic that he doesn't want to talk about, but he very clearly seems he's serious about not wanting to play for the Yankees.
So you think 2026, Vlad's free agent, Anthony Rizzo is, you know, is also a free agent, retired, whatever. The Yankees need a first baseman. They show up at Guerrero headquarters with a check is nine figures, starts at the four, and you think, you say, nah, rip it up.
I think that because, you know, if you're one of Vlad Jr.'s agents, you know, you might have some thoughts about this. And, you know,
that 5% of thoughts about this. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you were representing him, you might leak to a reporter, hey, just so you know, the Yankees called on Vlad Jr. And you might want that to pop up on MLB trade rumors if the Yankees do call, which who knows if they do. That's years from now. But I don't think this is a ploy. I don't think Vlad Jr. will sign with the Yankees. Like, I think he's serious about that.
It's so funny because, like, the way we know Vlad, like, he's so jovial, right? Yeah. Like he's just having a great time. And it's great being in the role I'm in this year on the sidelines because I get to just see him up close in the dugout a lot more. And like even after he makes outs, you know, and right now it's easy to have a great time when you're Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And like what's his weighted runs created plus is like 200 right now or something, right? Like he's just like he's off to this incredible start to the season. The results are amazing. The process is amazing. Like I promise you, his Savant page is all like super bright red. Like everything is going well for him. Defensively, he's a gold glover and like it's just spectacular at first base. It's everybody loves him. He's getting paid. Everything's great, right? So it's just funny to see him as like a villain somewhere and like kind of being booed and being hated somewhere because he is just such a jovial, like funny, relaxed, easygoing guy. It's not really the, like, you know, he's not like really a sandpaper guy. Like there's not a ton of edge to him. He brings so much joy and positivity and fun to the game. So it's weird seeing him in this position.
It really is. Cause like say with Alek Manoah, for example, right? Alek Manoah, the way he plays, the way he pitches, the way he speaks, the reality is some opponents are going to find that abrasive. And that's part of it. And is that always fair? Sometimes it's not. Sometimes, you know, maybe it is. But that's probably something that's going to happen with Alek Manoah. It's not a shock when a team is you know, barking at him for something. But with Vlad Jr., it just doesn't fit. He, you know, like you say, he's really a pretty jovial guy. He really loves playing baseball. He seems to get along with his teammates. He seems to really get along with fans. And yet, this is the one example where it's like that relationship, and you could kind of see it developing in New York over the weekend, kind of see it going to a different place. And I think it'll stay there probably for years, where that has now been established. The Yankees hate Vlad Jr. He says he will not sign with them. So there's some dislike going in both ways. And I think we're going to see that for the next few years.
He's very gregarious at first base. I think back to when we were in Anaheim and like him and Shohei are like cracking each other up at first base, which is amazing, right? Like Dominican guy and Japanese guy and are just like joking around at first base, like, haha, we're two of the best baseball players on the planet. Isn't it great? Like just watching some of those interactions, like he's just very warm and amicable. So it's gonna be funny to watch this play out over the coming years. What did you, you know, speaking of warm and amicable, what did you make of the reception, the response, the welcoming for Charlie Montoyo when he returned to the Chicago White Sox this week?
Well, you know, to me, I would have liked to hear from Charlie Montoyo. And I think that I don't know how many questions fans have for him. I think as a writer, as a journalist, certainly have some questions there. He chose not to address his time with the Blue Jays. That's his right. Doesn't have to. But I would have liked to hear from him. I think that he was an important part of this team as it developed. He was an important part of this team up until July of last year. He was fired. Managers get fired as part of the job. Doesn't mean he did a bad job. Doesn't mean he was not important. Ultimately, it didn't work. The communication toward the end was not there. That was not the right fit. John Schneider is a better fit for this team right now. But honestly, I would have liked to hear from him. And I think that, you know, you think about part of the role of a manager is to be accountable and speak to the media two times a day. That's, you know, it's a ton. These guys are incredibly accountable. And Charlie was always accountable to us when he was the manager of the Blue Jays. Now he's no longer in that role, no longer has that obligation or that responsibility. So I'm not saying he's sidestepping anything, but again, just as someone who covered that team, obviously our listeners followed that team pretty closely and followed Charlie Montoyo pretty closely. I would have liked to hear. I just would have been curious to see how he answered some of those questions.
It's pretty easy to deflect a lot of these questions too, and to even just kind of show up and say the same old stuff that everyone says. Yeah, I was really grateful for my time here. Yeah, you know, obviously didn't work out in the end, but man, they got a lot of great players over there. My focus now is with the White Sox. I'm loving working with some of these guys over here. Man, we have so much talent. You know, we're really going to come out of this thing. I know we aren't clicking at all. So da 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 da. Right? Like
you just wrote his talking points right there. Yeah, that's great. Put that on a cue card. And then review it once and you're good to go.
Yeah, there was just something a little uncomfortable about the whole situation at Rogers Center this week. And look, if Charlie doesn't want to talk, like, he doesn't want to talk about it. If he didn't want to be, you know, honored before the game, if he didn't want to have a thing on the Jumbotron, like, fine. Like, that's for him. Like, I didn't think that he would, it would be like, it wasn't like Farrell's return or anything, right? Like,
no.
Where, yeah, it wasn't like that. Yeah. But it was
John Farrell, like, abandoned the Blue Jays. He's like, yeah, you know these division rivals? I want to go manage them, and I'm going to. Like, that was obviously, and I wasn't covering the Jays really at that time. You know, that in hindsight, that's wild. That's absolutely wild. And he deserves every boo he ever got at Rogers Center. But Charlie Montoyo, like, I think he probably would have been applauded. You know,
100%. I think
the questions from the media probably would have been, you know, curious and polite and respectful, I would like to think. I mean, he was of no ill will. It's just, you know, I think he should have answered some questions.
I understand, like, if Farrell didn't want to do it, then whatever, right? Like, I don't even want to confront all that. But with Charlie, like, yeah, the response would have been very, very warm. And I imagine that he is probably, like, in terms of games managed, what, top five franchise history, right? Like, obviously, like, Gibby and Cito, Bobby Cox. But, like, I mean, like, Charlie Montoyo would be right up there.
He might be,
man.
Yeah.
You know?
So, Jimmy Williams.
Yeah.
Buck. But Buck didn't manage for that long.
No, Buck didn't have his. I bet you Charlie Montoyo managed the Blue Jays more games than Buck did, right? So, yeah, it was a little bit odd. And Teoscar, or did you touched on him? He's coming back this weekend. That'll be interesting.
Yeah.
So he'll talk for sure.
Yeah, I would think so. And I would think he'll get a great response. And, you know, and Teoscar is someone who I expect will embrace that, probably get a lot of comments from fans in right field and enjoy that experience. I hope he gets the chance to experience that because, you know, again, much like Charlie Montoyo, Teoscar was an important part of this team for a few years. And he had an emergence here in Toronto, had some really good seasons here. And I'm fully confident the fans will recognize that. I expect the Jays will recognize that in some way as well when he arrives this weekend.
Yeah, super interesting. Teoscar back in town. The Seattle Mariners back for the first time since last year's wild card series. Plenty of interest and intrigue for this Blue Jays season as it continues. And it's, look, they're playing well. They're a really good team. Expect them to continue being a good team. And they've just, like, been fun to watch, too. It's really, you know, interesting, exciting brand of baseball that they're playing. That's going to be it for us. He's Ben Nicholson-Smith. My name's Arden Zwelling. Our producers are Nick Andrade and Christian Ryan. You can email us at theletters@sportsnet.ca. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time on At The Letters.